I want to start out here by referring to a text that was written by Paul to Timothy, and he said two things in it. And you heard the first portion of it this morning, and he said, take heed to yourself and to the doctrine. So you heard about yourself this morning. Now I'm going to talk to you this afternoon about doctrine. Now, for a lot of you old-timers, this may appear to be old hash, but a lot of you who are younger, I don't think you're familiar with it, and I don't think you've researched it enough to realize what the issues really were back in 1975 and 76 when we left Worldwide Church of God and then when all this chaos set in. But to set the stage, I want you to notice something here in 1 John. Now, we're talking about taking heed to the doctrine, and notice what we read here. It's in 2 John, and here's what it says. Whoever transgresses, this is verse 9, and the actual meaning should be whoever takes the lead or goes ahead, assumes a responsibility, and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. He who abides in the doctrine of Christ has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into your home or house nor greet him, for he who greets him shares in his evil deeds. Now stop and think about that for a moment. What do you do when you turn on the internet and bring one of these heretical sites into your home? That's exactly what you're doing. So whether it comes in a person or it comes in the form of an internet, it's the same thing. So you need to be aware of that. That's a very serious warning. Now, as far as the subject today is concerned, I want to preface it with two or three texts here that should set the stage for you. First of all, let's go to Genesis 1 and verse number 5. Genesis 1 and verse number 5. And we read here about light and darkness. And so it says here, God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day, or a first day. So what do we have then as far as a biblical day is concerned? We have a dark period followed by a light period, roughly 24 hours. And when does the day begin? Well, it begins in the evening. That's why we're commanded many, many times regarding these various laws of God that it talks about even. Now, that being said, let's go to Leviticus chapter 23. And I want you to notice, I want to emphasize this because this is going to be covered in this article here, and it is certainly covered on our website article that was written a number of years ago. And you read here in Leviticus 23, verse number 4, these are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim in their appointed times. On the 14th day of the first month, at even, is the Lord's Passover. Now I'm reading here from the New King James Version, and probably the most authoritative Old Testament lexicon is the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament, and it says it means twilight. So that's what my New King James has in here. It says, on the 14th day of the first month, at twilight is the Lord's Passover. Now, if a biblical day is from even to even, then the Passover has to occur within that 14th day. And it has to be at twilight or at evening. And on the 15th day of the same month is a feast of unleavened bread. For 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. So here we have then the distinction between the first day of the entire period, meaning the Passover, and then the second day, the feast of unleavened bread, the 14th as distinct from the 15th. Now going to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 16, we read this. Deuteronomy 16, let's go down to verse number 6. At the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide there, you shall sacrifice the Passover at twilight, at the going down of the sun. Now, if we're going to look at the Passover on the 14th, and that's what the Bible says the day it is, then it should be quite obvious that that is referring to a period within 14 days. Now, this particular article I'm going to be reading from today was one that was sent out to a number of the brethren from a website, and it's entitled Exodus 12, When Was the First Passover? Now, that being the case, let's notice some things here. We read here from the author, the entire argument over the timing of the original Passover rests on the true meaning of between the two evenings. And that's exactly how it is translated here in Leviticus 23. It actually is between the two evenings. If between the two evenings means from sunset to dark, then the evening of the Passover meal and the death of the firstborn would have taken place on the night of Abib the 14th. Notice something here in John 13, verse 30. Here was the Passover that Christ was officiating with his disciples. And I'm going to read from John's account here, because you'll see something that took place here. They were having the dinner, and we read here in verse number 30, John 13, verse number 30, that here's Judas Iscariot, having received the piece of bread, he then went out immediately, and it was night. So that had to be at nighttime, didn't it? Now, if it had to be at nighttime, it had to be on the 14th, didn't it? So this is not talking about any other time period except the night. Now, as I continue in this article here, I have a printout of the original article on this subject back in 1970. I don't remember when I wrote it, maybe 76, because at that time there were all kinds of arguments coming out, pro and con, regarding the doctrines of the church. And I can say at this point today, there's not a single doctrine that hasn't been challenged or questioned. And the churches of God today are in a state of chaos. Now let's notice what I'm going to read here from this article. It is clear from the Bible and history that the original Passover was held at the beginning of the 14th day. Now, if it was held at the beginning of the 14th day, that meant at even as the sun had just gone down on the 13th. That's the only nighttime period you can have in the 14th day. Not until after the time of Christ and the destruction of the temple did the Jews substitute the Seder service for the Passover and mingle the Passover in days of unleavened bread, thus keeping the Passover at the end of the 14th day. No one knows when the two were mingled. Julius Morgenstern sums it up in a book entitled Significant Antecedents to Christianity. And here's what he said. The eating of the Paschal Lamb, and also at the same time the eating of the unleavened bread, and with this a commencement of unleavened bread section of the festival along with the Passover, all fell together on the evening of 1:14. In this manner, and at this time, the two festivals, now he's talking about the evening of the 14th, originally and independent of each other, but celebrated, just as we have learned, in immediate succession on the one festival, the Passover, to the other, unleavened bread, were formally and officially combined into a single seven-day festival. Now, is that biblical? You see, they took the 14th and they mingled it with the 15th, and then they called it the 15th, and that became the Passover on the night of the 15th, and I'm going to show you as I continue here what I mean. Still later, in post-Old Testament practice, that is after the Old Testament period was over, but still in complete conformity with the by time that was firmly established, the Jewish system of reckoning the day from sunset to sunset, the time for both eating the Paschal Lamb and for the commencement of the Masot, meaning the unleavened bread, was shifted from the evening of the 14th to that of the 15th. So they know it's a historical fact that there was a change that took place somewhere along the line. They're not exactly sure when that change took place, but many of them believe it was after the destruction of the temple itself, which occurred in 70 AD. Now, obviously, between the two evenings, and let me go back here to Leviticus 23, and we read here, on the 14th day of the first month at twilight is the Lord's Passover. So here we have the term between the two evenings. The Jews, now this is very interesting here. The Jews have always reckoned it, that is the Passover, to be from the decline of the sun after noon till the evening setting of the sun. Now what that means is they begin to interpret the evening as any time in the afternoon after 12 o'clock. So between 12 o'clock and the final going down, that's the evening. Now, if that be the case, how could the Messiah be keeping the Passover on the 14th, and it was dark when Judas Iscariot went out? If that is according to their reckoning, that would have been on the 15th. So you see very plainly here, he says that they always reckoned it from the time of the decline of the sun, afternoon, till the setting of the sun. Indeed, history shows that at the time of the Messiah, the Jewish priests fulfilled God's command by offering the evening sacrifices between 2:30 and 3:30 in the afternoon. That was a later innovation. Now, I have two articles here, one on the Pharisees and one on the Sadducees. And I'll read something to you because, as you recall, these are the people that Jesus dealt with, and these are the people who supposedly, and probably they did so, sacrificed the Passover in the daylight part of the 14th, from noon or 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So this article says, during the Hasmonean era, and that is during the time of the Maccabees, remember, they revolted against the Syrians who had control. See, when Alexander the Great died, there was a system of wars and fightings that took place between his various generals, and four of them ended up on top. And one of them was over what we call Syria today, or what we call Asia Minor in that area. One was over Greece itself. One was over Egypt. That was the Ptolemies. I forget where the last one was. There was the fourth division. There were four of them. Anyway, the Syrians got control of Palestine, and they introduced all these Hellenistic concepts. When I took Hebrew tutoring in Denver before I moved to Springfield, Missouri back in the late 50s, I remember reading from this Hebrew book that here was Socrates sitting there discussing matters with a friend, and his wife was angry, and she came out there and yelled and bellowed at him, and then she dumped a pitcher of water on his head. And his friend said to him, "Well, how can you put up with that?" And Socrates said, "Well, don't you know when it thunders, it always rains?" But what struck me was that here was this story about Socrates in the Hebrew literature. Where did it come from? It came from the Syrians who had introduced these Hellenistic thoughts, and so the Maccabees revolted, and there was a great series of battles that took place, and they gained their independence. And this is where we get the Festival of the Lights and the Feast of Dedication. That was a result of that. So here's what it says here. During the Hasmonean period, these Pharisees developed into an established political party of Judaism. And during the reign of John Hyrcanus, which is 135 to 134 to 104 BC, the Pharisees exerted a great deal of influence on the Jewish establishment. So what's the point here? The point is the Pharisees never even developed until very close to the time of Christ, about 100 years earlier. So did they always reckon it the way this man says? Of course not. And here's the Sadducees now. What do we read about them? This group probably arose as a consequence of the Maccabean revolt, the rising which overturned the priestly order of the program of Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, had so thoroughly Hellenized. So remember, Antiochus was the one who introduced the offering of swine in the temple and this type of thing, and then that's what the Jews revolted over. So from around the year 120 B.C., about 40 years after the Pharisees were developed, when John Hyrcanus broke with the Pharisees and favored the Sadducees as a group, they flourished until about 70 A.D. And with the destruction of the temple in A.D. 70, the Sadducees disappeared from the scene. They were the priestly class. Now, when did they start? About the same time the Pharisees did. So does that tell you that the Jews always reckoned it from noon until the evening? The answer should be very clear to you. Of course not. Now, let's go to another point here. According to the Talmud, the first evening is the time of the afternoon when the heat of the sun begins to decrease. Now, how many of you, you can look up any dictionary and the theological word book of the Old Testament spells it out very clearly. How many of you ever heard of the afternoon until sunsets as twilight? Is that twilight? Of course not. All right. When the heat of the sun begins to decrease about 3 o'clock, and the second evening commences with sunset. Now, let me mention something about this Talmud. The Talmud was a series of Jewish writings by the sages. There were actually two of them. There was a Babylonian Talmud, and then there was a one in Palestine, and they were often in disagreement with one another. And it was mixed up with the Gemara and the Mishnah. And one of them was a commentary on all the various legal arguments, and the other was a final decision on what the argument was. Now, when did this Talmud originate? From 200 to 400 A.D., and for them to say, according to the Talmud, the first evening is when the sun starts going down after noon, that was not a thing that originated until at least till after 200 A.D. So don't think for one second that the Jews always held to that. We know from the Bible record itself, it makes it very clear there in Leviticus that the even is the beginning of the 14th day, not the end of it. Now there's a statement by Josephus here. Let me read this to you. The Jewish historian Flavius Josephus, which originated about 150 AD, he tells us in the first century before the destruction of the temple, the Passover lambs were slaughtered from the ninth hour to the 11th. This time corresponds to our 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock p.m. Obviously, most of the Jews in Yeshua's day, and this man must be a sacred name man because he always uses Yeshua, which is the Aramaic name for Christ, understood that between the evenings meant the going down of the sun at noon until the setting of the sunset. Therefore, they slaughtered the Passover lambs on the 14th day of then called Nisan. Now, I'm not going to take the time to read the two comments. It's in the article itself on the internet. If you want to get a printout of this article, it'll end up as 21 pages if you print it out. But it's got a whole section here on Josephus' statement. And what they do, it's all listed right here. I won't take the time to read it to you because it would probably take too much time. They take two separate statements of Josephus. And neither one of the two statements does he state that it was on the 14th day. They put the two of them together and they make it say what it doesn't say by combining the two. Now, was it on the 14th day between 3 and 5 o'clock? Probably. Maybe I shouldn't go so far as to say that they may have been doing it. We don't know. It doesn't make it plain in the New Testament. And some of the authorities believe that the change did not take place until after the destruction of the temple. There is every reason to believe that the Jews and Christ kept the Passover at the same time. I'll show you as I proceed. Now, here's another interesting statement here. He mentions the book of Jubilees. Now, between the Old Testament period and the canonization of the Bible, which occurred under the time of Ezra, toward the latter end of the B.C. period, there were a number of spurious writings that came out, literally dozens of them, and they're called the Apocrypha, and they were regarded as uninspired. This book of Jubilees falls within that classification. It's not an inspired, never accepted as an inspired book. Now let me ask you this question. Do you think Ezra, who was a ready scribe and a man who was highly used by God in a whole period of history, was so dumb he wouldn't know the difference between what was inspired and what wasn't? These men were not stupid. So they knew perfectly well what was and what wasn't. So he says here, the book of Jubilees contains valuable information how the Jews kept the Passover 200 years before Yeshua. Well, I wouldn't put any confidence in anything the book of Jubilees says. It's rejected as not being inspired, and of course he doesn't explain what it was. Now here's another point. To support their beliefs, those who teach the Passover falls totally on the 14th of Nisan, which is what we believe. It has to be within that 14th day period, that the Jews refined between the two evenings to suit their own purposes, sometimes between Ezra and the appearance of Yeshua the Messiah. I don't think we've ever said that. I don't think we know when the change took place. But that's an assumption on his part. In taking this position, they are forced to reject all the available historical evidence and the inspired definition of between the two evenings found in Exodus 29 verses 38 through 41. Now let's go to Exodus 29, verse number 38. I'll show you something interesting here. Exodus 29 and verse 38 through 41. Now here's what we read in verse 38. Now this is what you shall offer on the altar: two lambs of the first year, day by day continually. One lamb you shall offer in the morning, and the other you shall offer at twilight. New King James Version. The King James says even. With the one lamb shall a one-tenth, all he listens to what goes along with it. And then verse 41, and the other lamb you shall offer at twilight, and you shall offer it with a grain offering. And this shall be a continual burnt offering throughout your generations at the door of the tabernacle. Now you have two twilight periods spoken of here. And in both cases, let's notice here verse number 41. It says here, between the two evenings. It says the same thing in verse number 31. Verse number 39 for the word twilight. Between the two evenings. Now there's a reason that they probably changed that teaching, altered the scriptures, because if you read the book of Deuteronomy, it's talking there about a festival of the Passover. There's more involved than just the Passover itself during that time period, but they're talking about the festival of the Passover, and they were holding it at the temple. They believed that that was set up first by Josiah. And so when you had such a large number of people coming in there, and they had to slay all these lambs so they could keep the Passover, then they switched it over to the daylight portion of the 14th rather than even when it should have been observed. So what you find here is you're looking at two periods called between the two evenings. Now, does that seem logical? That would be from 12 noon until the sun goes down. A number of you have worked out in the sun in the daylight. I had many jobs, and the hottest time of the day would be setting after about noon to one, but about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it would really get exceedingly hot. Now, I can tell you this, speaking for myself personally, and I presume the same thing applies to all you, I don't think you ever call that even, did you? Did you ever call that time period evening? That's why this translation here uses the word twilight. And that's why the theological word book of the Old Testament uses the word twilight. So what you see here is, in verse number 39, it's the word Erev, and here's what the theological word book says. Only in Job 7, verse 4, does it denote night proper. It means between the two evenings. That is Ben Averin. That's the Hebrew expression. So what that demonstrates very plainly is that the twilight period can only be late in the evening. And the clincher on that, as I pointed out earlier in John 13, verse 30. Judas went out and it was dark. Now, do you presume, can we presume that they sat there all afternoon having that Passover meal and then that went clear until dark and then Judas left after about a 6 or 7 or 8 hour period? That doesn't seem logical at all. Now, here's what he says. Shortly before his crucifixion, Yeshua, or Jesus is what we would use, told the multitudes and his disciples to follow the commands given by the Pharisees while they sat on Moses' seat. Matthew 23, verses 1 through 3. All right, now of course his argument for that is that since the Pharisees and the scribes sat in Moses' seat and they kept Passover from 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock in the evening on the daylight portion of the 14th, that's what we ought to do. That's what his logical reason behind that is. Now, if we go to Matthew chapter 23, notice what we read here. Matthew 23 and verse number 2. We read he was speaking to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do, but do not according to their works, for they say, but do not do." Now, let's stop and think about that for a moment. Notice what Jesus said in Matthew 16, verse 6. Matthew 16, verse 6. Jesus said to them, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." Now, you go down to verse number 12, and what do you read? They understood he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So now you have a contradiction, don't you? One place he says, beware of their doctrines. Number two, he says, go ahead and do everything they command you. One other text we need to examine here is in Matthew 15, verses 1 through 6. The scribes and the Pharisees, and by the way, the scribes were from both parties. They were either Pharisees or Sadducees, but they were a certain class educated in their schools who officiated in the religious sphere. The scribes and the Pharisees who were from Jerusalem came to Jesus saying, "Why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders, for they do not wash their hands when they eat bread?" And he answered and said, "Why do you transgress the commandments of God? Because of your tradition." You can be radicalized either to the left or to the right. One's as bad as the other. That's why the Bible tells you, you read it two or three times, do not veer to the right hand or to the left. Stay right down the middle of the road course. Don't get radical in either direction. And so what have these Pharisees done? They radicalized to the right. And they added all kinds of things. They had 613 do's and don'ts. And they decided that, well, now if you're Gentile, you only have to observe the six Noahide laws. And they list them, you know, like don't commit idolatry and don't commit adultery and stuff like that. Now, how would you like to be in a religion that requires 613 do's and don'ts? Number of them positive, number of them negative. And your life was spent like that. So that's what they had done. They had radicalized to the point where it was just absolutely unreasonable. And so he gives a little example here of what they were doing and ends up calling them hypocrites. So I won't read all the rest of that there. But now here's my point I want to make on Matthew 23. Do we have a contradiction? Did Jesus say one thing in one place and then turn right around in the other place and say, obey him, when he made it very plain they were wrong in their doctrines and you're supposed to follow their wrong doctrines? So what should be obvious is what he means here in Matthew 23. Therefore, whatsoever they tell you to observe, that means whatever is within the law, not their traditions. Very obviously. And so that's the point we need to realize here. Now, disproving the Sadducean Passover hypothesis from the Bible takes a little more effort. Now, this is one of the most misunderstood sections in the New Testament, and I believe it's covered in the article that I did on this question of the Passover, what's the correct date? But I want you to notice something here, because this is important. A careful reading of Mark 15, verse 1, in conjunction with John 18, 28, shows that the Sadducees, who ate the Passover meal at the night of the 15th of Nisan, at the same time advocated by the Pharisees. And then he quotes Mark 15, verse 1. I'll read them both to you. You can look in Bibles if you want to. Mark 15, 1, quote, "Immediately in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and the scribes and the whole council, and they bound Jesus, led him away, and delivered him to Pilate." Point 2, John 18, 28. "Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium, and it was very early in the morning, but they themselves did not go into the praetorium, lest they should be defiled, that they might eat the Passover." Now we have something very interesting here. Let's go to Luke 22, verse 1. Luke 22, verse 1. This is important. Notice it carefully. "The feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called Passover." Now what's that saying? That's saying that the whole eight-day period, that is, the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, were called the Passover. Here's an important point. The Jews did not have to be ceremonially clean to take the Passover. They could take it without being cleansed ceremonially. But they could not if they were going to eat what is called the Haggina. Now, what's a Haggina? All right. Let me read from pages 17 and 18 from our article here. And I hope that this won't drag on too long. My wife always tells me that whenever you start reading, you just go wild and people can't follow you. Well, you don't know the criticism I get at home. In fact, she'll say to me, "Well, you did it again today." And I said, "What?" She said, "You scratched your ear while you were talking." Now, here's what I want to read to you. An important key is found in Luke 22, verse 1, which makes the meaning clear. And then it re-quotes here, "Now the feast of unleavened bread drew nigh, which is called a Passover." The two terms, Passover and feast of unleavened bread, are interchangeable. This certainly was a usage in the time of Christ, and this means that in John 18:28 and John 19:14, and let's go to John 19:14 because I don't believe that was quoted here. John 19:14. "Now it was a preparation day of the Passover. In about the sixth hour, they said," and this is when they took him to Pilate. Preparation day for the Passover. Let me ask you this question. Is a preparation day required for taking the Passover? No. So we're not talking about the literal Passover. We're talking about something very eventful during that seven-day period that followed. So listen. John 19:14 does not refer to the Passover service, but the Feast of Unleavened Bread. What does the historical record show? Exodus 12:27 describes the sacrifice of the Passover. But there were more sacrifices during this general time period. Notice this text, and then this is quoted here from Exodus 23:15. Quote, "You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. Thou shalt eat unleavened bread 7 days as I command you at the time appointed for the month of Abib, for you came out of Egypt. None of you shall appear before me empty." Now, we fulfill that today by taking offerings during the three holy day period. One during the days of unleavened bread, one during Pentecost, one during the Feast of Tabernacles. Because it says three times in a year shall you offer an offering to the Lord. In the Old Testament period, it was carried out just a little bit different manner. Here's what we read. "Among these voluntary offerings," so there was a Passover itself, according to McClintock and Strong, which is one of the best historical sources I found when I was researching this many years ago, was the Haggigah, spelled H-A-G-I-G-H, Hag meaning festival. In other words, the sacrifice of the festival, which was usually offered on the first day of the festival. To make the offering, one had to be ceremonially pure. You could not offer an offering on the first high Sabbath day of the days of unleavened bread if you were ceremonially unclean. These offerings are listed in Numbers 10:10, Deuteronomy 14:26, 2 Chronicles 30:22, and included along with the lamb itself. And notice the instruction. Flocks and herds are included. We find that King Hezekiah and his princes gave large numbers of cattle and sheep as festive offerings. Now, when you read about the Passover itself, could you offer a calf or a cow? No. The only thing you could offer for the sacrifice for the Passover was a lamb. And yet we find here cattle being mentioned. So we're not talking about the Passover itself. We're talking about the Haggigah, the first high Sabbath day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, when this special offering was made. Edersheim, one of the New Testament authorities, tells us that the Jews were prevented by religious scruples from entering the judgment hall. This is just what we read in John 18:28. Let's go back here and notice it again. John 18:28. They led Jesus from Caiaphas to the Praetorium, and that was where the Romans had set up their headquarters, and it was an early morning. But they themselves did not go into the Praetorium, lest they should be defiled, that they might eat of the Passover. The Passover was held the evening before. So we're talking about the Haggigah. So what do we read here? To have entered a heathen house would have rendered them Levitically impure for that day until the evening. The reason is clear. This impurity would have had no bearing on the Passover itself, since it would have been taken after a new day had begun. So John 18:28, therefore, could not be referring to the Passover meal, but to the Haggigah. And in the Old Testament, both old and new, the term Pesha, which is a Hebrew word for Passover, was applied to all the Passover sacrifices, including the Haggigah, the great festive sacrifice required at all three feasts. Had the Jews entered the judgment hall, they likely would have contracted corpse uncleanness, because chances are there would have been some dead bodies around that the Romans were still officiating over. As such, they would have had to undergo a seven-day process of purification. I'm giving you all quotes here. I'm not telling you where this came from. Neusner, volume 34, page 230. So we see in the Mishnah that these rules of purification were confirmed. Christ took the Passover on the correct political day at the beginning of the 14th day, same time the Jews took it. He was taken into custody in the night portion of the 14th and executed in the daylight portion of the 14th. The Jews who had already partaken of the Passover meal the same night as Jesus did had no desire to defile themselves from entering the judgment hall during the daylight portion of the 14th. They had already purified themselves ceremonially and had no wish to be unclean for the Haggigah. That's where the real confusion comes in. So this fellow here doesn't even understand that. And he presumes it's referring to the Passover itself. None of those who brought Jesus to Pilate would enter the Praetorium. Why? John clearly states the reason. They wanted to be ceremonially clean so they could partake of the Passover meal, which was eaten on Nisan 15 after sunset. In other words, it would have been at the night to be much observed. I've heard the argument on this, and I think we have this covered in the article. I'm not going to take the time to go over it. But he's insisting that the Pharisees control the temple rituals. And since the Sadducees were the priesthood, descendants of the Levites, and the high priest was a Sadducee, that is an arguable point. It could have been just as well that the Sadducees controlled it and they decided what would take place. Now he's talking about the Apostle Paul here. He was a Pharisee. And Paul could not have said he was blameless regarding the law if he observed the Passover at the wrong time as a Pharisee. There is no indication that the Jews, both Sadducees and Pharisees, as well as Christ, observed the Passover on two separate days. That is a false assumption. They observed it at the same time because at that time it wasn't lost. Now, that being the case here, the inspired scripture indirectly shows the Pharisaic interpretation of Ben-Haavrim, which the Jews observed in killing the Passover, was the correct one, which was at the beginning of the 14th day, not the end. Nobody knows what happened after the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. In fact, Titus did not want that temple destroyed, but he couldn't control his soldiers. And one of them, they began throwing torches into the building. And whether you know this or not, marble can burn just like anything else. And they say that later on, when the gold melted and went down into all the cracks and edifices, people spent years tearing all those rocks apart trying to find the gold that had melted down in there. And another thing that people don't realize is that when the Romans destroyed the temple in 70 AD, they destroyed the entire city of Jerusalem and knocked it flat. Jesus said so very plainly. Jerusalem has been rebuilt seven times. from the contemporary testimony of Josephus and from the Talmudic authorities, there can be no doubt that at the time of Christ, it was regarded as the interval between the sun commencing to decline and the actual disappearance. The contemporary testimony that he's talking about is a lot closer to the AD period than what he's willing to admit. And as I pointed out, Talmud didn't even originate until after 200 AD. From a period of about 200 AD to 400 AD is a 200-year period the Talmud was completed. All right, now let me proceed here. If I can find the next point I want to cover here. Oh, yeah. Now, this is an interesting. One of the first things I always do when I get these articles, like this one, on trying to demonstrate that the Passover was held on the daylight portion of the 14th and into the 15th, the first question I always ask, what do they do with Exodus 12, verse 22? Most of them that I've read in the past just ignore it altogether. This fellow has a nice twist he puts on it. I'll read it to you here. This is Exodus 12, verse number 8. He gives the instruction about the Passover. Eat the meat roasted over fire, and do not eat the meat raw or cooked in water, but roast it till morning. If some left, then you must burn it. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked in your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand, and eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. Now, here's what this author says. Those who believe in a Passover falling totally on 14 Abib, have trouble explaining why God instructed the Israelites to eat the Passover in haste. As you can see from this passage, they were to have their belongings packed and dressed and ready to move out quickly. Yet there was no need for them to eat the Passover in haste, for their belts and their sandals and staffs in their hands, if they're going to not leave Egypt till a full day later on the night of the 15th, so why did God give these explicit instructions? Here's his answer. It is because he truly intended them to leave soon after the death of the firstborn. Now, the death of the firstborn occurred around midnight, didn't it? So what's he saying? They left the land of Egypt in the night of the 15th. In Exodus 12, verse number 22, in this particular case here, this is how he has interpreted it. Let's pick it up a little earlier here. Verse 11. Thus you shall eat it with a belt on your waist, your sandals in your hand, your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. Now, we got a problem here with the word haste. And this is from the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament. And here's what these authorities say. There is no clear distinction between the call and nephal forms of the meaning, which simply means there's no difference between the active simple and the passive forms. In these two contexts, its parallel terms mean fear, tremble, took to flight, hasted away. Some contexts give support, though less than decisive, for the meaning to hasten, that is, in terror. The hasty flight of Mephibosheth's nurse and the hasty retreat from the Armenian and so forth. Being in terror suits well the context, that is, consternation or alarm, and then flee in terror may summarize its meanings. The word haste is a rather poor translation. It should be translated here more accurately, so shall you eat it in fear or in terror or in trembling, because of what's going to happen. Now, they were told here specifically in verse 22, you shall take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood and in the basin, strike the lintel in the two doorposts with the blood that's in the basin, and none of you shall go out of the house of his door till morning. Now, what's the word morning mean? What's the word morning mean? Well, here's again from the Theological Word Book. Boker, that's the word. It's used at the end of night, used at the coming of daylight, used at the coming of sunrise, used at the beginning of the day, and used to bright joy after a night of distress. It's a masculine noun, meaning morning. And light through the cloud, the rifts, and point of time in which during the English morning, it's not called forenoon, and it means the end of the night. And that pretty well gives a summary of it. In other words, in every single case here, it means daylight or it means morning. So none of you shall go out of his house until what? Dawn, daylight, morning, not at night. Now his assumption is that God didn't really mean what he said. He just said you could leave right after midnight, and yet you read right up here in verse number 28, and the children of Israel went away, and they did so just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron. So did they. Now, if I can read the Bible correctly at all, that would tell me they didn't go out of their houses till the morning. They didn't go out after midnight. All right, now I'll read a little further here. There was no need for them to eat the Passover in haste. See, because we read then, he intended them to leave. Those who hold to the night of the 14th make a major issue of the Israelites not leaving their houses until dawn. They contend that per Moses' instruction, none of them dared venture out of their houses till to morning, because to do otherwise, they would have meant coming out from under the protection of the Lamb's blood. But do the scriptures teach us? So he's implying here, of course, that it doesn't. Exodus 12:29, and it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, from Pharaoh who sat on the throne to his firstborn and the livestock and so forth. The scripture shows that the death angel killed the firstborn at midnight. Once the destroyer had gone through Egypt, the tenth plague was over. It does not appear that there was any danger to the Israelite firstborn after the death angel had passed through the land. I wouldn't say that's very dogmatic, would you? It would imply to me he's not quite sure. Doesn't appear to be, doth not appear to be so. The scriptures clearly record that Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron by night, soon after the death of the firstborn. Although some try to make the case that Moses and Aaron ignored the summons, the text strongly suggests that they appeared before him. Now, remember, they were told not to go out of their homes till dawn. And yet, he says here, it looks like they went to Pharaoh. Did they? Let's notice what the scriptures say here. Let's go to Exodus 10, verse number 28. Here Moses was talking to Pharaoh, and we read in verse 27, the Lord hardened his heart. And then Pharaoh said to him, verse 28, get away from me. Take heed to yourself and see my face no more. For in the day you see my face, you shall die. And Moses said, you have spoken well. I will never see your face again. Now, did that take place? Well, let's go to Exodus 11:8. Here we find God telling Moses what's going to take place, and we read in verse 6, then there shall be a great cry throughout the land of Egypt, so on and so forth. None of the children of Israel shall a dog move its tongue against man or beast. You may know that the Lord does make a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. And all these your servants, now he's referring to Pharaoh, all these your servants shall come down to me and bow down to me, saying, get out, and all the people who follow you. Now what's that saying? Moses didn't go to them, they went to him. That's what took place. And if you'll notice Exodus 12, verse number 31, Pharaoh rose at night in verse 30, he and all his servants, and he called for Moses and Aaron by night. We got a problem here with the word for. It should be better translated to. He called to Moses and Aaron by night and said, rise, go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go serve the Lord as you have said. Did Moses and Aaron go down there? Not according to what we just read. Pharaoh's servants went to Moses and Aaron. So this man says, of course, here that although some try to make the case of Moses and Aaron ignored the Pharaoh's summons, the text strongly suggests that they appeared before him. I'd call that kind of careless research. Because if you read everything there, it says very plainly that they were going to come down to him. So that particular argument is another weak one. Here's a matter of spoiling the Egyptians, and I'll just read you what his conclusion is. The Israelites spoiled the Egyptians before the tenth and final plague. What's his proof? Well, here's his proof. Is it evident that the plundering occurred before the tenth plague took place? It had already happened before the Egyptians expelled the Israelites. That's why in many translations of the Bible, the account of the plundering in Exodus 12, 35 and 36, and you read here, the Lord had given people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so they granted them what they requested, thus they plundered the Egyptians. This is, of course, according to this particular text here, this is after the tenth plague. Because we read that earlier in verse 29. He says, the account detailing in Exodus 12, verses 35 and 36 is in the past tense, had done, had asked, had given. So I thought, now this is interesting. I have 28 translations of the Bible at home. Now, they're not hung around on the walls, on bookshelves, or on the internet. In fact, all of the biblical material I have on the internet, I might even go all around the walls in this room. That's how much is accessible. And so I checked them out, and you know what I found out? Only 2 out of the 28 use the past participle. Now, let me find this statement here, because this is important. This is a Hebrew textbook that I refer to from time to time. Because a good deal of what I learned back in the late 50s, I have forgotten much of it. And the reason I stopped tutoring Hebrew was because I was being transferred over to Springfield, Missouri. But that Hebrew teacher told me, and he was an Orthodox, he had a little skull cap and a beard, a very fine man, his name was David Yehuda. And he told me that if you stick with me 6 more months, I'll have you speaking fluent Hebrew. Well, I wasn't interested in speaking fluent Hebrew. I was just interested in seeing to help me in Bible study. And I'll tell you what I learned. This is the most important thing you need to realize the Bible. The context is all important. If you don't get the context, you're not going to get the meaning, and that's the key. So that's what I found out. But here's what this textbook says. Tenses, Hebrew tenses. Strictly speaking, biblical Hebrew has no tense similar to those used in English, French, or German. The action is regarded as either complete or incomplete. Hence, most scholars prefer to call it a completed action, they call it perfect, and an incompleted action, imperfect. In the present tense, the Hebrew expresses a completed action. Thus, the word lahag means, now here's how it can be translated. This is what the problem is. I studied, I have studied, I had studying, I had been studying, or I did study. Be translated in all those different ways. So just because you may find it in the past participle in a translation doesn't mean that that is exactly the way it should be translated. That's the problem with Hebrew. It's not that specific. Now, Greek went overboard. Well, I shouldn't say overboard. God selected that as a language because it's the most precise. And for every single Greek verb, there are 100 different forms. How do you like to study Greek? German is bad enough. Because in German, you have to analyze the sentence in advance because there's all kinds of declensional endings that have to match the various nouns and verbs in before. And if you don't analyze in advance, your grammar will not be good. I sat there and listened to Germans talking when I was in Germany, and they'd be sitting there correcting their declensional endings. Because here's their own language, and they'd even make mistakes. Greek is much more complicated than that. So here's what you find. The imperfect expresses an incomplete action. I shall shut. I shall be shutting. And for the time being, translate the imperfect as a simple future. And that's what modern Hebrew does. The imperfect is translated in a future tense. So what that really tells you here is, for him to say that it means it's a past participle, you can't prove it. There's only two translations out of 28 that shows it that way. The rest of it show it different forms. None of them put it in the past participle. Going back to the point raised earlier, did the Israelites wait until the first light to leave their homes? Or were they expelled during the night? The scripture does not conclusively tell us either way. Well, I'll tell you what it tells me. If they did what Moses and Aaron commanded them, then they stayed in their homes. That's very clear. Deuteronomy 16:1 seems to imply that Pharaoh expelled them before dawn while it was dark. Well, let's read that text here. Deuteronomy 16, verse 1. Observe the month of Abib, keep the Passover to the Lord your God, for in the month of Abib, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. Now, what's his argument here? His argument is, they went out on the night portion of the 14th, but the Bible says the 15th. Now, if they were going to go out on the night of the 15th, then they left their homes in the daylight portion of the 14th. Remember, a biblical day, even and morning, night and light. All right, they left their homes that morning after the sun came up, and they gathered at Ramses, and then they left Egypt that night, the night of the 15th. That's exactly what we read here in Numbers 33, verse number 1. Numbers 33, verse 1. These are the journeys of the children of Israel who went out of the land of Egypt. And it gives a list of their points, their camping points. They departed from Ramses on the first month of the 15th day of the first month, the day after the Passover. The children of Israel went out with a boldness in the sight of all the Egyptians. 15, not the 14th. So again, it shows you, it says, it seems to imply that Pharaoh expelled them before dawn while it was still dark. Now, who are you going to believe, the Bible or this application that's put here? As I said earlier, that's the first thing I ask myself when I read one of these articles. What do they do with Exodus 12, 22, and 28? Most of them, as I said earlier, they just ignore it. They won't even bring it up. This one here, he puts a little twist on it. They're going out in the night when the Bible says not to. Numbers 33:3 tells us the Israelites departed from Ramses on the 15th of Abib. They were forced to obey the command of Pharaoh and exhortations for the frantic Egyptians to start their journey out of slavery on the night, or just as the daylight portion. Abib was dawning just a few hours after the death of the Egyptian firstborn. Now, who'd they listen to? Did they listen to God, Aaron, and Moses, and God, or did they listen to Pharaoh? See, that's the question you need to ask. And as he says here, just a few hours after the death of the Egyptian firstborn. Now, if the Egyptian firstborn were killed at midnight, what would a few hours be? A couple hours later, wouldn't it? So that would have them leaving around 2 o'clock, maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, at night. So it should make it very plain to you that practically every point in this particular article is in error. And as I said earlier, I had one member tell me when he gets these things, he doesn't even read them because we've gone over this so many times in the past. And I would say, if you have not really studied all this material, this doctrinal material that we have on the internet, then you better do so because you're going to be vulnerable. And you're very likely to get swallowed up and caught up in something that can very easily lead you astray. So as I said earlier when I started this sermon, there are two things that Paul said you better take heed to. Take heed to yourself and to the doctrine. Both of them are extremely important.